Welcome to Out of Material with me, Alexander Desi. In this series, I will be exploring the working minds of material scientists, specialists, designers, and thinkers, contemplating consumerism, design, sustainability, and climate change by looking to the future of material innovation and emerging technology. Philip Stankard is the lead industrial designer at 3M and is responsible for a $7 billion medical consumable portfolio. He has also held design roles at GE Healthcare and Matrix Fitness, prioritizing consumer experience in design. Philip, thank you very much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So your career has taken you from fitness to healthcare. The overarching story there is design for people and their bodies. This requires you to see humans as complex systems rather than solely consumers, workers, or hedonists. There's an intimacy and a vulnerability associated with people's personal health. Since often design is about appealing to the masses, how is that gap bridged between mass appeal and the extremely personal nature of healthcare? How do you bridge that gap between universally applicable healthcare options and the particular needs, emotions, and perspectives of each individual?
Yeah, and that's the problem. You know, it's a challenge within being a designer within a healthcare company. You know, you're trying to make solutions that are applicable to, you know, populations. And the future of healthcare, for lack of a better term, is going to be like personalization and customization. You know, how can you deliver sort of that sort of universal solution, but also make it customizable per patient to really address their sort of unique healthcare needs. So I always think where like healthcare is so huge that there's so many players in the game and there's so many options for treatment now that really like the future of healthcare is just building out more and more of these like options and like niche sort of solutions that fit a lot of variety out there. Because it's definitely a challenge trying to, you know, make solutions that appeal to the masses, but also, you know, leave some customization where it can be tailored to unique patient needs.
Great. Talking along that line of this overarching story that can encompass humanity as a whole, as we see healthcare getting better, options for prophylactic care increasing in the past even 100 years, we've seen incredible advances in what we can do to prevent diseases from happening before serious symptoms start happening. Then you get to this interesting moral question of, well, where do you stop? At what point do you say humans, can they live forever? Can we just keep administering healthcare? Should healthcare be administered in every situation where it can be? Do we just keep going? You know, where do you see the trajectory of human existence going?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, it's like when I think a lot of people gloss over the fact that like diet and health can really sort of impact their longevity in life. So I think that there's a lot of upfront education that needs to occur, you know, just from understanding, you know, fitness levels and diet levels, like how can you improve your lifestyle through just some real I think to do items like that. You know, it's definitely unique in that healthcare does try to address a lot of those issues, but there can be a lot of education in other areas to really improve one's health. And to your point, it's like, yeah, when do you stop? I mean, the longevity of people's lives is really, it's increasing, you know, decade to decade. So it is definitely an interesting trend to make aware of.
One of the issues here is that fundamentally the healthcare industry is an industry and it's a business and it's a profit-making enterprise to an extent. So these issues around, okay, so maybe the best option is to educate people and get them to think about their own lives, but there's no product attached to that. There's no real market value attached to that. So how do we make that shift towards just giving out pieces of valuable advice to help people live their lives in a better way while theoretically tailing off on growth under capitalism.
Well, it's interesting. It's like when you're making pharmaceutical drugs, or you're making different sort of like healthcare treatments that treat cancer. You know, like, it's like this never ending sort of loop where it's like, well, you know, are they going to be out of business if cancer stops, you know, existing? And it's like, how do you treat the systemic sort of root of a lot of these issues? And it does kind of go back to, you know, a healthy lifestyle. And a lot of it does kind of circle back to some of the basics. Yeah, it's quite the industry when you think about how big it is and how there's all these different elements to it, all these different elements of care, for sure.
So something else I wanted to bring up with you is that quite often when I go to places like hospitals and airports are the two places that spring to mind, I kind of struggle a bit with just these feelings of not really enjoying the space, you know, being there and thinking, mm-hmm. Oh, it's very clinical. There's like a certain atmosphere, but within that, there's so much to do with the materials in the products that people have to engage with, the interior design of the hospital itself, just the way people perceive their environment. And I've spoken in the previous two episodes of this show about the sensory perception of materials mm-hmm. for consumers. And I think patients in a hospital is a really interesting use case for that, because it's such you're being taken out of your comfort zone, you're being placed into an unfamiliar situation with people looking after you and potentially carrying out operations and things that you may or may not understand. You're in a totally alien world, and how do we make sure that the people going into care mm-hmm. feel at home and feel settled?
Yeah, it's interesting because most of my career has been around industrial design for the actual like object for healthcare, but we're seeing a lot of trends in the actual like spatial design. So things that you're bringing up, where I've seen a lot of reports on the benefits of just having a window in your patient room and being able to look outside and having natural elements to sort of immerse yourself with, whether it's like greenery outside, whether it's, you know, organic materials inside the room, whether it's lighting. There's some cool work that's being done with a lot of like medical imaging machines, like MRIs, CTs, x-rays. They're fairly large in that they embody an entire room. So I've seen companies like Philips and GE and Siemens actually design the rooms that those machines live in and really control the environment with like lighting, like that sensory sort of detail that you're talking about, using lighting and sound and even scent. There was some interesting work being done with GE Healthcare where they were creating sort of like an adventure series for children. And one of the adventure series was, imagine like a storybook come to life. So they were looking at sort of this jungle adventure, and they were actually, they had like Glade plugins in the room to sort of bring up this pina colada sort of scent. So it had like a jungle beach sort of atmosphere to it. So there's a lot of overlap, I think, with the healthcare industry is starting to look outside healthcare to get inspiration. So they're looking, you know, hotel chains, you know, different sort of like spa treatments, and bringing some of that, those elements and those sort of relaxing elements into that space too. Like every other industry, it's constantly trying to reinvent itself and really look outside itself to get inspiration. So yeah, I think like the spatial design, the interior design, the architecture, that's going to be like ever evolving. And a lot of the products that live within that healthcare space will start to adapt and sort of become more, you know, contextual with the environment.
Yeah, I think that's a really promising trend mm-hmm. towards this like interdisciplinary, intersectional work where things just start to coalesce, you know, you start creating mm-hmm. spaces where it might not just be a hospital, it might also be a social hub and things like nurseries and things all coming together and using these same ideas.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much opportunity beyond medicine to improve someone's life too. So I think just what you brought up and the example that I mentioned earlier, just like having natural elements to sort of look at, like sunshine, greenery, but even to your point, like social hubs, I mean, that would be huge just to improve the mobility of someone, to get them out of bed and have them move around the hospital floor and interact with other people. I mean, that really does improve someone's sort of treatment outcome too. So there's a lot of interesting things within architecture, I think, that could really help, you know, really drive the healthcare industry in a whole new direction.
So the next thing I wanted to ask you about is medical consumables and the fact that they tend to have little to no room for reusability, really, mainly down to things like biohazards and recycling issues, especially this year. You know, you've seen thousands and thousands of pieces of PPE ending up in the oceans and in nature. And outside of the pandemic, things like test kits and pill bottles and toothbrushes as well. You know, there's that great little fact where every single toothbrush that's ever made still exists somewhere. And I, you know, it's been good to see examples of refillable systems becoming more popular, modular approaches to these things, where you're just swapping out a small part of the overall product. But one thing I've seen is that it seems harder to convince people that things can just be, you know, they don't have to always be replaced every couple months or whatever, you know, with people buying new toothbrushes every Christmas and just throwing the old one out. And the example I've got is why is it normal to throw away multiple toothbrushes every year, but use a replaceable razor where you just swap the head out every time you need a new one. Mm-hmm. Whereas with toothbrushes, the whole thing just gets thrown away. Actually, I saw something today that was like a stainless steel toothbrush handle with bamboo heads that just, you know, you swap them on and off when they run out. And that's something, you know, that's moving in the right direction, but it's an interesting thing to think about that certain systems have been adopted and have been around for a long time, like the razor example, but other things, it seems like there's a bit more uncertainty with consumers about what's, you know, because I think especially in medicine and in healthcare, there's a lot of people do just have to trust the experts and just say, oh, I accept that what someone tells me is hygienic or what someone tells me is good for me. So it's quite hard to change perceptions.
And that's the challenge within healthcare, is that, you know, that reusable model is it's, why doesn't it make sense for healthcare? It does in certain instances, but then one of the main themes within the hospital setting is, how do you control, you know, you want to prevent infection from spreading from patient to patient to patient. And there's a lot of fear around reusing equipment just based around that idea that they want to contain the infection. They want to, you know, for each individual patient that comes into the healthcare setting, that individual patient will consume their own sort of, you know, small quantity of consumables. And you're right, the majority of like what's being consumed in the hospital ends up as it's deemed medical waste. And with medical waste, you know, you've got, it could be soiled with blood or any sort of fluid. It could actually have some biomatter on the actual, you know, material. So it does more often than not, it gets incinerated. It's interesting because some of the hospital chains will actually have their own like reprocessable reclamation type of program set up to handle, you know, paper, cardboard, aluminum. And it could start to expand, you know, as companies like 3M and other medical consumable companies, the attention for those companies would be start to understand, you know, that waste stream and, you know, the workflow of using the product, but then also the end of life and how that object is being treated, if it's going to a landfill or if it's being, you know, incinerated on site. There's a lot of big question marks, and each sort of hospital chain has their own sort of unique workflow for how they deal with end of life on products. And then you have a different mandate in America and different mandate in EU, and then different mandate in Asia. So there, it's globally, it's changing across a lot of those different markets. But yeah, right off the bat, I can just tell you from a designer's point of view, understanding the cradle to grave of your product is really helpful. And then just keeping a mindful, just being mindful of the material itself and how, you know, maybe there's some opportunities for sustainability or to, you know, maybe it doesn't need to be injection molded plastic. You know, maybe it could be another material and it would actually benefit in some sort of, you know, user need or user feature. So there's a lot of things that can be examined up front, and it doesn't need to be this assumption that, oh, you know what, it has to be a hard plastic, because it could be something else too. So, and we've engaged a few programs at 3M, and it's been interesting where the market is starting to respond, and the market wants to see alternatives and a lighter footprint of a product. So there's a lot of cool stuff happening. I've seen with hard goods, with surgical instruments, there's a lot of attention around reprocessing. So, you know, you'll get, just take a scalpel, for example. You know, that scalpel, it's going to get sterilized in the hospital environment, and it's also going to get sharpened. So it's going to get, it's almost the second time it reappears, it's clean and it's sharp. And it's been inspected. So it's almost like it's better than the original product, because it's gone through this whole sort of like reprocessing cycle. So there's some cool stuff where hospitals are actually, they almost get excited with the product getting reprocessed, because they know that there's like a certain level of quality, you know? So it's kind of interesting to hear that happen for like hard goods. And then to your point, there's still a lot of work that's going to need to happen in order to integrate a lot of the sustainable materials for
companies. Yeah. Well, you end up back at that point about completely disparate industries coming together on things like this. Like the last person I interviewed on this podcast was Paolo Nerlich, who has made a material out of like factory waste from the chocolate making process. And she kind of compacts it down and makes a solid material out of that. And to do that, you need a relationship between whoever's producing the material and a chocolate factory, you know, and you need to have communication about where that waste stream's going and say, okay, well, you don't have to do anything with it, but we'll step in and we'll take this resource that we think is valuable and we'll turn it into our product. You know, the burden doesn't have to be on, for example, the hospital to say, oh, let's reprocess all of our waste. It leaves that gap for people to come in and say, well, look, you've got the material resources, you're throwing them out. If we can take your used scalpels and turn them into razor blades for reusable cartridges, then who knows? Yeah. I think, you know, it's all about just finding these connections that people may not have considered before.
I was really blown away when we've done some projects with some hospital chains, and we've done the cradle to grave sort of examination. And I've seen a few examples where they're actually reclaiming a lot of, you know, paper products throughout, you know, the hospital setting. So from their cafeteria, from patient rooms, et cetera. And they were actually bundling a lot of the final paper products and then reselling them to, you know, people who were using it for home insulation, who were actually, you know, repurposing that sort of like shredded paper waste into other products. So it's interesting to see people really take the end of life or like the waste stream and actually turn it into a profit. So that is occurring, is that there are vendors and suppliers who will take that waste and reconvert it into something else.
And the great thing about that is that all that waste then has the story as well. You know, it's not just, oh, we've got this material, we've made a product. This is material that's come from, you know, a really important use case, and we've taken it. And it just adds that extra level, I think. Mm-hmm. We've talked before about this rush to always use plastic in rapid prototyping. So lots of people use standard FDM 3D printers for small model making, but it's not that great of an option for people who are in that kind of sustainability space, which I think all of us are or should be, you know, at this point. So rather than being a model for new manufacturing methods, so rather than saying, okay, eventually everyone's going to have a plastic 3D printer in their home and they'll be making everything out of plastic, how can these new methods of production shape design thinking and foster more sustainable approaches without being directly sustainable approaches themselves? Just the action, maybe, of creating these, you know, small scale models and being able to iteratively design and say, okay, so here's a mock-up of a product made in plastic, but it's getting us towards the goal of let's design things from a more global systems perspective and think about waste streams and sustainability and things like that.
Through the design process, you know, it's always going to start off with, you know, some sort of, you know, illustration to communicate to the team, hey, this is kind of like the concept idea. And then at your point with a lot of like hard goods manufacturing and well, I should say with a lot of hard goods product development, you're going to go from a two-dimensional sort of idea that's like on paper that everyone kind of blesses and approves to something that's a little bit more three-dimensional that can be interacted with. And that prototype, that three-dimensional prototype might be customer facing. So it could have like the fidelity of like, oh, this is what it's going to look like in real life. And yeah, to go from 2D to 3D, you know, there's a lot of iterations that occur. And I think a lot of designers are pretty sensitive to, you know, this idea that, you know, it's going to evolve. It's going to take time. And it's you're not really married to one concept, because from 2D to 3D, there's a period of time where you might make, you know, 10 plus, 50 plus like mock-ups to really hone in on the solution. And I think a lot of designers are pretty sensitive to the fact that, yeah, one of these concepts could be a throwaway. You know, I'm not going to get too married to it. So a lot of people do kind of tend to maybe make more like low fidelity mock-ups. So to your point, it could be 3D prints. It could be ABS plastic. It could be foam core. It could be paper models, cardboard. So, you're making a lot of waste, you know, to find that sort of solution. And then there's a lot of different sort of interesting Mr. Potato Head type of activities that you could play in between, where it's like you almost have a blank slate and you give that toolkit to a customer and have them build the solution. So there's a lot of waste in product development. And I've seen a lot of people really put attention to the materials that they're using to prototype. You know, and I think it just goes back to, you've got with rapid prototyping, you have a lot of the bigger players are Stratasys, who are making a lot of 3D printers. I would imagine everyone is so sensitive about the footprint that they're leaving behind. I would imagine a decade from now, maybe paper prototyping would be a little bit more of an option, maybe even like remelting the 3D print. You know, I don't know, there's got to be some level of like, you know, how can you reclaim it and how can you reuse it?
Maybe that'll be the move towards things like VR modeling and just taking everything out of the physical, just moving into the digital world and just saying, we don't need to even create anything. We can do everything digitally and then just have one prototype that we make.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many, you know, there's no rules to the game, right? So it's really however you what tools do you really need to solve the problem? And, you know, with digital modeling and VR sort of modeling and VR sketching, I think that could be definitely an area to pursue. You know, it doesn't always need to be something three-dimensional.
I'm thinking about this, the distinction that people make between man-made things and the natural world, and kind of just considering that from the perspective of, well, why does that distinction need to exist? Because everything that we do, everything that's created, is still all part of this entire global system of materials, physical laws, natural processes. We're all governed by the same rules. So something man-made is still just an amalgamation of the exact same materials that make up the natural world. It's just been done in a different way. And from that, start thinking about biomimicry, being something that's always been a very powerful design tool, but often manifests as taking something from nature and applying it to something totally different, rather than looking for this synthesis, you know, rather than saying, let's abstract humans as much as we possibly can from nature through things like VR, you know, taking everything out of the physical and saying, let's just go the computational route and make everything a simulation. The opposite direction to that is, how do biomaterials play the role in really strengthening our relationship with nature, especially in this time of climate change and, you know, people really, really wanting to make a difference to the planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my example earlier with, you know, and it ends up either in sort of, you know, the landfill or being incinerated, you know, it's always kind of important for us to look through, you know, and search out alternative sort of materials. And I think everyone's probably familiar with like the mycelium sort of mushrooms. And there's a lot of energy around sort of these organic matter and how you can almost get it to perform as like a plastic or something, you know, to a hard good sort of level. I'm always intrigued with those natural sort of explorations into materials like that and how they could start to become, it no longer becomes sort of like this oddball, it becomes sort of the norm, you know, and I'm kind of excited for the next couple of generations that are coming up, because I think that's the expectation, is that, you know, maybe plastics were, you know, they're dated, and there's sort of this appetite to really sort of create newer materials that have that sort of sustainable sort of end game.
Yeah, I saw a really great project of this guy who's created like a coffin for that just just decomposes, you know, and it's compost for plants, and you know, yeah, that's the real, like, oh, let's just really go back to nature and just turn ourselves into a tree. And it's like cradle to grave idea, like coming into full force.
Yeah, there's a lot of those interesting ideas. And I, you know, it's funny when you think about like the funeral industry, like that seems to be like, yeah, no brainer, is that you want to have some sort of like alternative material like that. You know, maybe you put your ashes in something and then it sort of evolves into a tree. But yeah, it is kind of interesting when you start to think about it. You know, especially within that industry.
So the last thing I wanted to touch on was just, you know, with this growing digital age that we find ourselves in, you know, everything's online now, everything is virtual. And we've really seen a growth in digital platforms for showcasing designs. You know, you essentially have to have some kind of online presence as a designer. And that comes with its own pressures, like got to be putting out material constantly. It's got to be of a good standard. You know, there's this expectation that people will be posting on their Instagram stories every day and that kind of thing. And I wanted to ask you whether or not you think there's been a shift towards just designing for that, you know, to please the algorithm, to get clicks, and to grow your audience, versus designing things that are actually useful and are actually going to solve problems in the real world.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, it's always been like that. You know, I think design, there's sort of that, you know, there's that appetite where you crave attention, you want to really, you know, you want to shine. And I think Instagram and Behance and a lot of these portfolio sites do a good job of, you know, giving designers that sort of corner of the internet where they can really post and share their work and get creative input from other designers. So it's wild, you know, like I've been doing this for about 15 years and it's just wild to see how much it's grown. And it used to be Cora Flott, then it went to Behance, and now it's Instagram. And it's just interesting to see when people do post work, not only designers are commenting on it, but a lot of people outside of design too. So that's exciting, because I think it's, in the end, more people are starting to become more aware of like design, and it's not just this, it can be a variety of things. It can be, you know, industrial design, software design, it can be service design. And the more people are posting about it, the more that's becoming more common knowledge, you know, to a lot of people. So there's, it's, and then what you're kind of talking about is like, yeah, there's like a lot of prompts that take maybe a week to go from a concept sketch to a rendering or something that's shareable. So yeah, I'm always kind of nervous because like the amount of time to go from concept to shareable is pretty short. So, you know, are you really doing your due diligence of the design process where you're identifying, iterating, and delivering? So yeah, you know, it is what it is. It's sort of like a microwave version of a design, you know, like it's like, like at the end, it's really appetizing, but it could be a little light, you know, it doesn't have that sort of, you know, that sort of meaningful execution. But, you know, when you go, the flip side is that it's usually like 12 to 18 months to get something from concept to, you know, off the factory floor. So it does take time. There's a lot more that you have to navigate in terms of, you know, working with all these other disciplines and then understanding your end user and your customer needs. So two different, you know, it's definitely two different things, but I think like with, you know, everything that's happening online where a lot of designers are posting, I see nothing but good happening from that, because I just see it as like, you know, and I love, like, I think vaporware and advanced concepts, I think they have a home anywhere. And I think in organizations as big as 3M, I think they value that as well. You're just seeing a lot of it happen online because, you know, from what I've seen with Render Weekly and a lot of these sort of prompts, they're very quick. The turnaround super quick. So yeah, you could probably ding a lot of designers and say, well, you didn't think about X, Y, and Z. Well, yeah, it's like, of course, but they kind of went with action and they saw sort of a window of opportunity and they just kind of leapt out of it. So, but yeah, nothing but positive things, I think.
It's interesting to see the internet as almost like a big sketchbook, you know. For everyone so that's where everyone puts their ideas and shares their ideas, and you get this big network of people from all different
it's
avenues.
It's cool, man, and like I think the more active you are, that it does come back to you, because I've had people message me and you and I have connected on a few times, and it's just engaging to be able to put something out online and then have a response, and then you're starting to connect with other like-minded individuals. And, you know, so I see, like, if you don't share, you're doing yourself harm. You know, you're not like, no one knows who you are. And it's a good way for you to put something out there and see, you know, who else thinks the same way, or you know, and really build a relationship that way.
Yeah, similar to what you were saying earlier about in the healthcare industry, perhaps the future isn't so much about just delivering healthcare options. It's more about educating people and letting them find their own way in life. It's almost a similar idea can be applied to design and say, well, yeah, you just allow people to feel their way, you know, put stuff out, just ideate into the ether, see what happens, and see who stumbles across. You know, all it takes is one person to find it and think the same way as you. So it's, you know, it's more about getting those ideas out there than providing concrete products or solutions.
And, you know, the easiest way to become a designer is to design. And I think a lot of people do get stuck in that trap of, well, if I have a 9-to-5 job, you know, that can really like meter your sort of, you know, your creativity, because you know, you're not in a few weeks' time, you're not going to go from concept to rendering. You're going to have to really kind of be at the pace of the program. So it's slower when you're a full-time designer. That 9-to-5 role is a little bit slower. And I see, like, you know, everything that's happening, you know, online is just kind of this enrichment, you know, where you can kind of, it's your sandbox, really. Yeah. So why not?
Yeah, thinking beyond what you can do.
Yeah, right, and I never understood the pushback to all of that too. You know, I think there's a lot of people that kind of, you know, they might fault it because it's not real. You know, I think that it comes down to that maybe sometimes. Yeah. I don't know.
Who's to even say what's real or what's not to a certain extent, isn't it? You know, if you go far enough.
True.
Down the VR rabbit hole eventually.
Yeah, and it's cool, man. I just get a kick out of, you know, with everything that's being shared online, you do get a sense. It's not like you have to go on a design blog to really get a sense for like what the trends are. You're seeing it happen live from a lot of the, you know, the key designers that are posting online. You're starting to get a sense for like, okay, this is what's current and this is what's now. And this is what's sort of on the top of everyone's mind. So it's cool, man. And if you, I think as any good designer, you want to kind of tap into that and you want to be able to kind of dissect it and understand a little bit better. So yeah, it's nothing but a good thing to be plugged into those type of threads.
Great. Well, I think that's everything I wanted to ask you. But
cool. Yeah.
It's been, thanks for really great. Me. Yeah, you're very welcome. It's been really, really interesting conversation. Really enjoyed it.